Blog Talk Radio.
And Jesus was a working man. Jesus was a working man. He had muscles of steel and calloused hands. Always had a master plan. Yeah, Jesus was a working man. Jesus was a working man. He had muscles of steel and calloused hands. He played in a rock and roll band. Yeah, Jesus was a working man. Jesus was a rocking man. Jesus was a working man.
Jesus was a working man. This is Paula Thompson coming to you from Blog Talk Radio, The Cosmic Citizen. Today I have a very dear friend on the radio with me, Jim McNally, and our dear friend Chrislyn B. Larson. She'll be joining us soon, I'm sure. Anyway, Jim, are you with us?
I certainly am. Thanks for inviting me, Paula.
It's so good to have you on. You know, Jim and I have a history, and just by way of giving you guys a little information about Jim, I first met Jim, I think, back in 1977 at a study group in Boulder, and he has always been the guy that makes everybody laugh, and sometimes he makes you groan, but mostly he makes you laugh, and he was my personal mentor in the Urantia book, which... I wish everybody could have a Jim McNally. In fact, you were the reason that John Hay launched the Boulder School, because his thought was, wouldn't it be great if every community had a Jim McNally in it to answer their questions and be, you know, such a scholar of the Urantia book. So, but I know I called you endlessly and bugged you, you know, mercilessly about, Jim, what do they mean when they say this, and what do they mean when they say that? And you were always so kind and so patient to answer all of my questions. So you will always have a very special place in my heart, my dear friend.
Well, thank you so much. And I've really forgotten more than most people know. And so as soon as you start asking me some fresh questions, you'll find how much I've forgotten.
Well, and I think we have our dear friend Chrislyn with us. Chrislyn, are you here?
I am. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hi, Jim.
Well, good morning or afternoon, whichever the case may be. Nice to hear your voice, Chrislyn.
Me too.
Well, as you know, we are dedicating this whole month, and this is the last show we're going to do, at least for now, on humor. And we invited Jim because he's our Urantian reversion director. He makes us Urantians laugh by pointing out some of the silly things that we believe and do. And I know you have a host of characters that you love to portray, Jim. You have Reverend Jimmy, who likes to read from The Meaning of the Death on the Cross. And Swami Gowanananda, I like that one, Swami Gowanananda, he's a perplexed reader trying to make sense of the various quotes in the book. And then Mel Hafadek.
Mel just showed up at the UCLA International Conference a couple of years back, and I figure we've got Veranda Dex and Lananda Dex, and it's time that one of the half a Dex made his appearance.
He's only playing with half a deck. Is that how it? Oh, that's great. So maybe you can start by giving us just a little bit of background about yourself and. For folks in the audience that don't know as much about you as I do and as Chrislyn does.
Well, I've been on the planet close to 60 years now, and as I wrote in the Cosmic Citizen blog, born in Chicago, Illinois, and but basically grew up in California, where I first came across the U-Book. I think it was 1965, and a friend of mine brought me over to his house to see his new motorcycle, and his mom was kind of a psychic, and she just looked at me and she said, "Oh, I can see by your aura that you're just spiritually inclined. We've got to get you reading the Urantia book and start getting you practicing meditation," and on and on. And I said, "Well, gee, it's nice to meet you too, ma'am. You know, what in the world is she talking about?" And then I read it a little bit at that time. She let me borrow a copy for a few months, and but it didn't quite hit. And then of all things, my mother gave my father a copy of the book for his birthday in 1969, and I looked at it and said, "Oh my gosh, that's the book about the universe and everything, and all about, you know, history of the earth and the life and teachings of Jesus and cosmic citizenship." And they kind of looked at me and said, "Whoa, boy, what was this book?" But it was a year after that that a friend who was going to move across the country and backpack and didn't want to take the big 3.5-pound book with him came by and gave me a copy of the book. And that's the very book I still read to this day. And so I've been a pretty avid U-Book reader since about October 1970.
Wow. And has your opinion of it changed at all in as many years?
Well, when people ask me, "Jim, how you found the Urantia book?" my typical answer is, "I found it interesting."
I like that.
Very good answer.
I found it interesting. Yeah. I still no doubt about it.
Well, I've probably read it a dozen times in and outside of study groups. I don't read it quite as much, that it's so imprinted in my brain. I wrote a essay in, I think it was the Brotherhood Bulletin back around 1984, called "The Theocentric Model of the Universe." And in that paper, I wrote pretty much what I still feel today, that it's the paradise pattern and the way the book is written and the idea that God is at the center of the universe and should be at the center of our universe, too. And it's a tool to help us move from an egocentric view of the universe into a theocentric view of the universe, and that the way it is written and its pattern and its holistic approach, and as I believe, the paradise pattern in the words itself imprints itself in our thought process, where we become thoughtful the way that the way the book, the paradise pattern within the book, shares with us. And so in that sense, I still feel it's a tool for helping us get a new view on ourselves and on the universe, and not put ourselves at the top and recognize that we're just here to be of service, and we're just one of many trillions upon trillions of God's wonderful children.
So true. And it's, I think, a healthy way to view it, and because it is a tool. You know, it's not here to supplant our relationship with God, but to ignite it. And it certainly does do that. It did that for me, and it continues to do that for me on a daily basis.
Been a huge enhancement for me.
Yeah.
And I think one of my favorite things about it, too, is it says that, you know, the more spiritually you grow all the better sense of humor you should also have. You know, it really helps us to realize that spirituality or religion doesn't have to be taken so seriously, or not that it shouldn't be taken seriously, but that we don't have to be so solemn in the process of communing with God.
I think that our ability to laugh and to laugh at ourselves is a true saving grace, and that when we get so caught up in the frothiness of the religious egoist, the ability to make fun of ourselves and to laugh with our friends and to just have joy and mirth, and I think it's very significant that one of Jesus's ongoing admonitions was to be of good cheer.
Yeah, that's true. Always was his admonition, be of good cheer. And on this planet, sometimes it's hard to remember that. And I think that's why, like you said, Krystalyn, that's why it's so important to remember, to take time to find mirth and laughter and true joy. And always that's something that's shared. I mean, you know, we see that on the internet constantly. Somebody sends you a joke. Krystalyn sent me something that made me laugh so hard I cried yesterday. And I highly recommend it. It is just absolutely hysterical. It is this cat riding on a, what is it called, a Roomba?
A Roomba, yeah.
A Roomba vacuum cleaner. And there's not just one cat. People have like videoed their cats riding on this thing. It's become known as the cat amusement ride. And you can go to you could probably go to YouTube and just type in cat riding on Roomba. I can't even think about it without cracking up because it is just hysterical to watch these dumb cats. And they're not really, they're just taking it in. They're grooving with it. They're totally in a groove with this thing. It is absolutely hysterical, and animals make me laugh. I just get the biggest kick out of them, especially pets, and that it's their antics. And I think probably one of the reasons we like having pets is because they make us laugh. But anything that makes us laugh has to be a good thing, from what I can see.
Well, when I grew up going to church, I was always admonished that you're supposed to be pious and quiet and sanctimonious, and that I think it's, you know, good to be respectful, but that I think that the religion of Jesus is a little more dangerous. I think it's prepared to step on out and to really have some fun and do some serious belly laughing once in a while. And I think that humor, it's a great truism, is the best medicine, or as it's commonly said, laughter is the best medicine.
I'm sure we shared this on the show in one of the past three shows, because we started with Swami Beyond Ananda, and then we had the Laughing Guru and his Hapidemic, Dr. Madan Kataria. And last week we had Errol Strider, and this week we have Jim McNally on, and he's our Urantian king of laughter. Errol's pretty funny too, but yep. This is a quote from Jesus in Instructions for Teachers and Believers, which is just an all-time favorite for me.
Did I lose you guys?
I'm still here. Paula, are you here?
I think we just had Paula drop off.
I had that problem quite a bit last week, so we may have to just give her a minute to call back into the show. So,
well, some of the things that I've found a bit ironic or humorous in the Urantia book perspective is that It's not designed as a technique of personal salvation in the traditional sense. And what I mean by that is that so many people go to a religion with the idea of what's in it for them. You know, how can I be saved, or how can I get to heaven? And when you get to the core of Jesus' teachings, you kind of take that for granted, and your issue is, how can I be of service instead, not what's in it for me?
And
I'm really touched by the story about the coming of the planetary prince to our planet, that over 700,000 Jerusalem citizens volunteered for the 100 assistants, the prince's staff. And the idea that even when you're on an ascended sphere, the one of the highest forms of service that you can do is to be on a world of time and space and be of service in the here and now. The idea of a descending sun coming down into the world, somewhat as the concept of the Bodhisattva, the enlightened one coming back into the earth. So many people have the idea that they want to leave this world and go to heaven, and then we find out that people who are already there are trying to get back here to be of service where the action is.
Right. And here we're already here, and we don't even have to wait in line or sign up to get here. We're already here, and we can use this time as productively as we want in any way to be of service.
And so we've got so many people consumed with the idea that this is an evil planet, or the world of sin, or the fallen planet, and it's just absolutely miserable. But Michael Sun himself, you know, chose this as the place where could really illuminate some of the great contrasts of divinity and highest truth. Against the darkest background comes the greatest light. And I think that's somewhat of what we experience in the joy of service, in that there can be so much great uplift and so much great opportunity to be of service, so much need here, that this is a place where great things can and do happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have to tell you guys that I keep getting kicked off, so I hope you are not. Are you able to carry on uninterrupted? Because that's the second time I've gotten kicked off the air. And
we have, but we don't know if they can hear us. But we've still been talking. We can hear each other.
I think they can. I had to call in. That it's the second time I had to call back in. So Larry's going to mention it to Blog Talk and see. I know that happened to you last week too, right, Crystal?
Yeah. I was off the air, I think, almost more than I was on the air last week.
That's kind of strange. Yeah. Well, you know, this is live radio, and it's really a new technology to do this kind of a show over the internet. I mean, we've been doing it for a couple of years now, but it still has bugs from time to time, as we all know, if we tried to host a show or do one. So thanks for carrying on, you guys. And I love what you were saying just then.
Just for the record also, I can't get onto the chat room either. So
you can't, okay. Yeah, and you almost don't want to mess around, because then, you know, the whole thing can go haywire on you. So anyway, Jim, you know, I was hoping that we could get you to do a couple of segments from some of your favorite characters, like the Reverend Jean.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do something like that for us?
Well, we've got a full 2 hours to be... Well, entertain the dozens of people that are listening in. This is kind of a cool study group we've got going here. What I'd like to do is share some of the. Well, why don't I start with some of the first works of humor that I did? That was probably back in 1973 at the West Coast Urantia Conference, which a lot of people thought was the first of what are now the international conferences. Prior to that, most of the gatherings in Chicago were mostly for those in that particular area and were, you know, typically less than 100 people and were, as I had been told, pretty much dry lectures. But in 1973 in California, there were some new readers who had joined, really the first of the counterculture or the hippie generation, the long hairs who came on in. And I think a lot of the older readers really expected that white shirt and black tie and clean-cut, somewhat Mormon types of youth were going to be coming to the book. And they were somewhat taken aback by the flowery shirt, bell-bottom, sandal, you know, ponytailed, you know, bright-eyed youth that showed on up. And at that time, there were a lot of older readers, and then the young ones showed on up, and I jokingly referred to it as a gathering of newlyweds and nearly deads.
Gee, that's almost what we have now.
And so in that first conference, I wrote and, well, I'm not sure I performed in all three, but I wrote three different plays. One was a tale of a Urantia greeter deciding to play a trick on a mortal from Urantia showing up upon their first day of resurrection, and you know, pretending to check in the Book of Life to see if they were there and things like that. And, oh, we're so sorry, and this and that, and the poor mortal is all, you know, nervous and what the heck's going on here. And Grand Fonda himself then showed on up and, you know, straightened out the Urantia greeter and said, everyone's resurrection should be as exciting as his, the very first of the ascended mortals to survive the death experience. And that was just one example of what I would call taking the lower and putting them as the higher, taking the poor ascended mortal and showing them how important they are. And I think that's a big part of the humor that the Urantia book talks about is our so-called superiors getting having a check in their smugness. And I think that's a big part of what began in 1973 was the youth showing up and basically turning the movement on its ear and having some fun, and Buffy St. Marie was singing, and we put on a play of Adam and Eve, you know, having kids that, you know, were trying to turn off the communication system where their folks could be calling them through the special glands in their you know, brain. How do we turn this thing off? Mom's calling me. And having to get help from a local native how to get their unruly Fandor to fly. You know, just fun little vignettes. And you know, there were people who, you know, thought that we were socialist infiltrators. There were people who were really concerned about the Urantia movement. And I think that the whole joy and humor and singing has been so important that the young readers back then brought into the movement to the point where we finally got it to really lighten up.
Well, you know, your story about Adam and Eve reminds me of for years I went on the road and did these expos with Urantia book readers all over the country, and we would start on a Thursday and have a little bit of a training meeting and gathering, and then Friday we'd set up our booth at an expo, a New Age fair essentially, and for 30 straight hours we'd talk about the Urantia book until we were blue in the face, and then on Sunday night, we'd always go out to dinner and just kind of debrief and talk about some of the interesting people we met and the great conversations we had. And we were sitting around, this was in Seattle, we were sitting around the table, and Marvin Gowron was telling us a story about Julia Fenderson, who I'm sure you remember, Jim.
Oh, yes.
And love dearly. And she was one of the grand Urantians on the West Coast. And she really took in a lot of these wonderful young hippies that came into the movement back in the 70s and became such a hero. And one of the things she loved to do was periodically she would have a costume party at study group, and everybody would show up as a character, a favorite character from the Urantia book. And this was just for kicks, just to keep it light, you know, and fun. Because it is an intellectual book, and it is dense and deep, and, you know, you really struggle with it sometimes. So she liked to just keep it light, and as Marvin was relating this story, it so happens that one of the nights that she was scheduled to have this costume party, Urantia Foundation had gotten an inquiry from a fellow who wanted to go to a study group, and they recommended Julia's. Well, this poor fellow didn't know anything about Julia or her study group and didn't know at all that it was a costume party that night. And so he shows up at the door with book in hand, and Julia was dressed up as Mother Eve. And she had affixed a flashlight behind her head so that it would create a glow. And she was all in full regalia, and everybody in the group was in full regalia, various costumes, mighty messengers, archangels, you know, the whole nine yards. So this poor fellow comes to the door, book in hand, and knocks on the door, and Julia answers the door dressed up, you know, as Mother Eve, and he looks at her startled, and he says, "Who are you?" And Julia says, "I'm Mother Eve." And he looks around her and he sees all these other, you know, all these other people dressed up. And he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I think I must be in the wrong place." And nobody ever heard from the poor chap again. At least not that we know of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so sad.
Well, that one of the lines that I heard at a conference in Chicago. It was at some university campus, and just a passerby had started up a conversation with some book readers and asked the question, "Well, what is Urantia?" And the reader answered back, "Well, it's the name of our planet." And the guy said, "Okay, great, glad you're here. Earth is the name of ours."
Yeah, I've heard a similar one of the, I think it was like one of the leaders of the fellowship went to scope out a conference site, and it was, you know, more of a liberal Christian organization, and they were walking along with the minister who was in charge of running the conference center, religious conference center, and he was showing them the facilities, and as they were walking along, and he had obviously been dealing with a lot of quote-unquote New Agers and, you know, alternative religions, let's say, and he said to the guy, he said, "So, what is the name of this group you're with?" And the person responded, well, we're readers of the Urantia book. And he said, yes, okay. And what is Urantia again? And the guy responded, well, it's the name of our planet. And after a moment of thought, the minister said, oh, okay. Now, where is this planet you're from?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's just, we do things, we say things like that, I mean, not knowing or not even thinking how absurd
mm-hmm.
we might sound, but at least it lets us laugh at ourselves, which is a good thing, you know, because...
Well, why don't I share some of the, what I think, where Swami Gwanananda thinks are humorous little bits from the papers, like one on page 980, where under the paper on sin, sacrifice, and atonement. And it says here, finally, animal substitutes came into general use for sacrificial purposes, and even among the more backward tribes, dog eating greatly reduced man eating. I was thinking, you know, if that became ritualized, would that be a dog eat dogma?
Dog eat dogma.
Oh, man.
I like the bit and the time after the tomb on page 2030 where the apostles had been told about Jesus' resurrection, and it said that Peter fell into grave doubting.
Peter fell into grave doubting.
Grave doubting, right. Boy, and there's some... Oh, another little favorite of mine is on the census takers. That's on page 266. This one, I think, is a real hoot. let's see, I'm having to scroll through the book here. And that's on the... higher personalities of the, then it talks about the census directors. Okay. It says here, the census directors are a special and completed creation of the infinite spirit, and they exist in numbers unknown to us. Yeah, a lot of good they do, right? Don't even know how many there are.
They forgot to count themselves. That's pretty good.
Oh, boy. We all recall that section where Jesus, in one of his travels, was having a discourse with a philosopher, and he went on to say something like, you know, you're... eloquence is great, but your teachings are hardly true. You know, the guy just, just really laid him out. And that Jesus had no problems letting the supposed superiors get their comeuppance, whether it was throwing the money changers out of the temple or, calling the Pharisees out. And I think, though, that we have to be aware that since so much of humor is a taking down of the ego, that I know that in my life one of the things that I've had to be very aware of, and I think is one of the first spiritual obstacles that the U-Book has helped me to overcome, and that's taking that too far, and where teasing and too much humor becomes an attack on a person and can actually become mean. So we have to be really cautious in our use of both self-degrading humor or in bringing other people down, that it doesn't become bitter, that it still has to have a sense of mirth associated with it and a sense of friendship and camaraderie. If it isn't bringing joy, if it starts to bring pain, we have to be really careful about too much of a put-down.
I think it's always important to avoid making fun of others and just make fun of ourselves. I mean, it's pretty hard to offend somebody when you're making fun of yourself. Although, I've been known to manage to do both.
Mm-hmm.
Well, humor is something, wouldn't you say, that is that can so easily be misunderstood?
Especially when it's in two dimensions, like in a chat or on the internet, and that even with the smileys or the emoticons, I think humor is lost on a lot of people, and there's a lot of folks out there who, I hate to say it, seem to have no sense of humor at all, and don't appreciate irony, don't appreciate the complexity of it all, and they're so incredibly literal that I don't know. It's you know, that's one of the things that I love about the Urantia book, is that it is spiritually uplifting, and it really does teach you know, boundless humor and joy, and I think it brings a true light into a somewhat dodgy world.
Well, and you have to ask yourself, I mean, really, to me, humor is about gratitude, in a sense, because you start to look at what you do have to be grateful for, what you do have to be joyful for. I mean, Jesus said often, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, and be of good cheer, you know. And sometimes you look around on this planet and you think, wow, you know. But we are barraged by negativity often through the media, and so we forget to look at dedicated, devoted human beings who go out every day and serve others and do good works and make a difference in people's lives. And all of the things that we have working for us, like Jesus told the young man on the hillside, you know, hey, look, the sun comes up every day to salute you, just as it does the richest and most powerful man on earth. And you know, we take for granted all that God in His goodness has provided for us, that we might create a life of joy for ourselves, in spite of all that you know, the difficulties that we deal with. And so ultimately, I think being able to laugh is just being able to step outside yourself for a moment and realize that all is well.
Well, so many people are complacent with the religion of authority, whereas the religion of Jesus is one that you have to think for yourself, and that you still have to respect the opposite conclusions of others, and occasionally go against the theological grain to build your own theology. And there's no creed or dogma, and there's no set of unchanging rituals. And so it's something you really have to think about and work at it. You have to struggle with hard questions, and occasionally you have to worship with people you may not agree with or get along with, and still like it. And in that sense, the ability to transcend oneself, and this is courageous religion that has, you know, moved out of the safe harbors of traditionalism and authority. And I think that's something that a lot of book readers have to come to at a point in their lives, too, that they have to recognize that the Urantia book is not an authority. It's just a tool, and that it's not going to create the foundation of a new inerrant scripture, and that at a certain point, the book is a type of scaffolding that people have to transcend and move out from and become living faithers, and that if you're relying entirely on belief, then you're not fully engaged in the challenge of life. And this is a great, great challenge, and that the same tool that brings us such fabulous insight and understanding is something that we can't lead with. We have to become joyous, living faith sons and daughters of God, and that's that takes, you know, the joy of the adventure, the call of the open road.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's see. At this point, I'd like to have a moment of silence. Okay, I think that was long enough. you know, I have one real prayer, which is, oh, all-knowing one, you know.
All-knowing one, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
And tell you. Well, you know, Crystalline, you sent me a joke, and, you know, over the internet, you get these things all the time, and some of them are really funny. You sent me the cat riding the rumba, and that was hysterical. But you sent me another joke that was actually very clean, and sometimes I find, you know, that the cleanest ones are the funniest ones, and I like them the best because you can share them with everybody. I think I've expressed that, you know, a big milestone for me in my life was to be able to stay in the room while the joke of the day was being told. My dad was a policeman, and so he would come home from the police department with a joke every day, and they were seldom ever clean. and policemen, you know, and I think I expressed this already, but they need that humor because the stress of that job is so intense. That it's just crazy, but the joke that you sent me was about the farmer and the DEA agents that came to inspect his farm.
Oh, right.
Do you have that?
Oh, it would take me a while to go back and find it. But
oh, I can find it. I'll find it. This one is priceless, you guys. I mean, I sent it to several of my friends and my sister, who absolutely, you know, my family. I mean, I know, Jim, you can relate to this because I'm sure your family shares jokes and humor. I know your brother Pat is just so funny.
Well, I have one that I sent recently, which was about Pat and his wife Edna, who go to the state fair every year.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
Pat would say, "Hey, Edna, I'd really like to ride in that helicopter." And Edna always replied, "I know, Pat, but that helicopter ride is $50, and $50 is $50. One year, Pat and Edna went to the fair, and Pat said, "Edna, I'm 75 years old. If I don't ride that helicopter, I may never get another chance to do this." Edna replied, "Pat, that helicopter ride is $50, and $50 is $50. The pilot overheard the couple and said, "Well, folks, I'll make you a deal. I'll take both of you for a ride. If you can manage to stay quiet for the entire ride, I mean, don't even say a word, I won't charge you a penny. But if you say only one word, it's going to be $50. Well, Pat agreed, and so did Edna, and up they went. The pilot did all sorts of fancy maneuvers, but not one word was heard. He did his worst daredevil tricks over and over again, but still not a word. When they finally landed, the pilot turned to Pat and said, "By golly, you know, I did everything I could to try to get you to yell out, but you didn't. I'm really impressed." Pat replied, "Well, to tell you the truth, I almost said something when Edna fell out. But, you know, 50 bucks is 50 bucks."
I love that one. "I almost said something when Edna fell out." oh, my gosh. Here's the one Crystalyn sent me. And it's called "The Arrogance of Authority." This one just cracked me up, too. I love that one, too, Crystalyn. That was a good one. A DEA officer stops at a ranch in Texas and talks with an old rancher. He tells the rancher, "I need to inspect your ranch for illegally grown drugs." The rancher says, "Okay, but don't go in that field over there," as he points out the location. The DEA officer verbally explodes, saying, "Mister, I have the authority of the federal government with me." Reaching into his rear pants pocket, he removes his badge and proudly displays it to the rancher. "See this badge? This badge means I'm allowed to go wherever I wish on any land. No questions asked or answers given. Have I made myself clear? Do you understand?" The rancher nods politely, apologizes, and goes about his chores. A short time later, the old rancher hears loud screams and sees the DEA officer running for his life, chased by the rancher's big Santa Gertrudis bull. With every step, the bull is gaining ground on the officer, and it seems likely that he'll get gored before he reaches safety. The officer is clearly terrified. The rancher throws down his tools, runs to the fence, and yells at the top of his lungs, "Your badge! Show him your badge!" Oh, man, I love that one. And it's kind of what you were saying, Jim. The reason that that came to mind when you were talking about, you know, the authorities and what the Chicago Old Guard must have felt when the hippies all came into the movement, and it was more of a who let them in here response rather than the wonderful young people are coming, you know.
Show him your badge.
One of my favorite humorous readings from the book was one that was first shared with me by our friend Mo Siegel, and that's on page 1215, and the Adjuster and the Soul. So it's talking about the soul and the body, and that how the Chinese had the yin and the yang, the soul and the spirit. And it says that the Egyptians and many African tribes also believed in two factors, the ka and the ba, but that the soul was not usually believed to be pre-existent, only the spirit. And then the ka was supposed to be a superior spirit genius which desired to guide the associated mortal into the better paths of temporal living, but more especially to influence the futures of the human subject in the hereafter. When an Egyptian of this period died, it was expected that his ka would be waiting for him on the other side of the great river. At first, only the kings were supposed to have kas, but eventually all righteous men were believed to possess them. You get your ka, and you go off to heaven.
Especially if you're from Boston.
And I think that probably one of the greatest ironies of the Urantia book cosmology is one of the things that I think is really funny is the idea that death added nothing to the human experience. That we've got so many people who are going through life really believing that when they die, they're going to be magically transformed into fully enlightened spiritual beings. And when they show up on the designated mansion worlds, and they find out that they're picking up exactly where they left off, and the same lessons that they didn't learn here on Earth, they still have to work them out. I'm thinking, yes!
Yeah, there's no way out. But
there's no justice for those. There is justice. There's karma that truly works in that effect. So as far as your pet evils, and trust me, I have a whole kennel full of them, that is something that you can take with you. You may not be able to take your physical possessions or your money with you, but you get to take your pet evils.
Yeah, I like that. Having a pen for your pet evil. Very good.
A pen for your pet evil. That reminds me of Joanne. Our friend Joanne Weidman said that she had a dream one night. And in the dream, it was very vivid. She was walking along with her angel. And she was, you know, she knew that she was in the next life. And walking along and noticed this big gray blob on her shoulder. And, you know, the book says that, you know, in the next life, our inner life will be more directly reflected outwardly. It won't be, you know, like in this life, somebody can be really beautiful but really messed up on the inside, but you wouldn't know it to look at them. Well, in the next life, your inner life will be more directly reflected outwardly. So she's walking along with her angel and this big gray blob on her shoulder, and she said to her angel, "What's that?" And the angel just said, "You're going to have to work on that." you know, you don't think about things like that, but you were talking earlier, Jim, about, you know, kind of imagining what life in the mansion world is like, and we love to think that it's just all glorious and wonderful, and I know it is, but there's going to be some things that are going to be interesting for us too, and shocking maybe. And I was thinking about that one day, and I had this, you know, like this little vignette came into my mind, and it was two beings, and they were standing together on the mansion worlds, not, you know, just maybe not far from the resurrection hall, and or even within the resurrection hall, and there was a group of people standing off by themselves, and one being says to the other, "Who are they?" And the other being says, "Oh, them over there? Oh, yeah, they're Urantians. We call them Agendaunters. They think it makes them special." because here we have been in isolation. It's kind of like we may not know. I've often thought if we were, and it tells us, if we were plunked down on a world settled in light and life, we'd think we were in heaven. But the other side of that is, if we were plunked down on that world, we'd probably feel naked in our inadequacies, you know?
Well, that's, again, one of the great ironies that I think is portrayed in the Urantia book, and I think core to its whole cosmology, is that the Heavenly Father is incomplete. The nagging divinity tension of the question, would God choose to be God if he had the choice not to be? It's just, you know, a great paradox, and the whole concept of the Almighty Supreme of all of the worlds of time and space acting out of these the children of God, mortals such as ourselves, going through life, choosing whether or not to be a part of the ascension plan or not. And the idea that to be human is God's will. To be here on earth is what God intended. To have the experience of life and the experience of pain and temporality is so that we have the ability to choose the higher. I find that just so remarkable. That cosmology is quite unique to the Urantia book, and I find it quite inspiring that when people say, oh, I can't wait till I, you know, die and can do God's will. The Father already escaped from infinity to indwell finite beings. Why are we trying to, you know, give up on this? I mean, this is God's will that we are here, to be here on earth, to be good parents, to be good neighbors, to try and bring heaven on earth as it is in heaven. That paradise, properly qualified, can connote any and all forms of universal reality. We're already in paradise. We're already in a light and life state of mind. Jesus experienced it while here on the planet. It isn't somewhere else. It's somewhere within us, and it's within our grasp, and it's really what we strive for. There is not somewhere else we're going to. Where we're going to is to be here now.
Such a wonderful point. And, you know, something you said earlier is really touching to me because it's so true. There's beings all over this universe who would love to have the opportunity to be on this planet right now and be a beacon of light and life on this world. Because you can make the opportunity to make a difference, to really serve a true purpose, a noble purpose, is so great right here, right now.
I've heard another one about God looking down on earth, and he saw all of the rascally behavior going on, and he sent one of his angels down to look into it, and the angel returned, and he told God, yeah, you're right. It's really bad down there. He said 95% are misbehaving and only 5% are not. Well, God was just not pleased about this at all. So he decided to email that 5% that were good because he really wanted to encourage them and give them a little something to keep them going. You know what the email said?
No, what did it say?
Well, I just was wondering because I didn't get one either.
You didn't get that memo.
Let me get back to some of the silly quotes from the book.
Well,
here.
Wait a minute. Before you do, Jim, we have a caller. So let's see if they have a... 830, you're on Blog Talk, The Cosmic Citizen. Hello? 830? Maybe they're just listening.
Okay.
That happens sometimes.
let's see. This is on page 852. The first part is exactly to the point of we were just saying that Adam and Eve were distraught after the realization of their default, but then when they found that this world would be the home of a paradise bestowal son, it says, it seemed too good to be true, but Adam did entertain the thought that strife-torn Urantia might, after all, turn out to be the most fortunate world in the system, the most envied planet in all of Nebadon. But I think it's even more than that. I think there's something really special going on this planet, that the spiritualized adjuster of Jesus, the Master Son, is, I believe, at work in a very special way, not just helping to bring about planetary uplift in ways that might seem incomprehensible even to the members of the 4 and 20 or other angelic groups trying to bring about greater health and truth and beauty and goodness here on this world. I think that the Master Sun is using this backdrop of the most isolated world in all of the universe as a way to show the greatest enlightenment and perhaps even a revelation of the ultimate in time and space of the most aware human, Michael, Jesus, then his personalized adjuster here on the planet, revealing a presence of God that, because of the so-called backwardness of our world, that we may be able to be experiencing while here on Earth the greatest contrast of coming from virtually no revelation to a supreme revelation in a single lifetime, and to be able to reveal to all beings of all of the worlds what a true faith son can do when their faith becomes so completely wholehearted that the Master can live within us and to live and do through us, just like the Father did through Jesus. And that the Master Son, I think, is showing us a way of such incredible service that it isn't just uplifting the people on this earth. It isn't just being the great world of Satania or Nebadon. I think there's a revelation of profound service that is inspiring for all of the galaxies and even of all time. And I think that that's why this is the greatest time to possibly live in, and that those individuals who have been shared the gift of the paradise pattern within the Urantia teachings, if they're choosing to actualize service in their lives, the opportunity to be a part of an even greater light and a greater revelation is a gift that I believe the Father wants to bestow through our lives. And to me, this is, again, one of the greatest ironies, how the lowest can become a revelation of the highest.
Wow. Thank you so much for that. That was just truly, truly beautiful. And so, so true.
Well, let's get back to the silly now. Right after that little bit, back on page 852, it says, Adam lived for 530 years. He died of what might be termed old age.
What might be termed?
We might term it old age, yes.
Oh, boy. Well, one of my...
You know, you wonder if they say this stuff tongue-in-cheek.
You know, who writes this stuff? I mean, gosh, yeah. I mean, when you have material like this, anyone could be a comedian. Okay. Well, let's see. You think we're ready for the Adamson and Rata story?
Absolutely.
Oh, of course.
Oh, God.
One of the best in the book.
This is my favorite. I remember the first time I read it from, again, the perspective of not just reading it, but, I mean, trying to figure out what they're really saying here. And it just, I don't know, it seemed kind of funny to me. And, well, let's see what, let's see how it plays in this tough crowd that we've got here. Because most people know that there were people already on Earth, you know, when Adam and Eve were here, and one of those groups were the Nadites, descendants of the original prince's staff, you know, who then lived in the land of Nod. And after the default and after the first garden, the oldest son of Adam and Eve, Adam's son, decided he wanted to strike out on his own and perhaps, you know, find the land of Nod and a different group of people that he might be able to start a second garden with. And so I'm just going to read this. This is from page 861. And let's see if you kind of sense the, again, I think, cosmic humor. Adamson was 120 years old at this time, had been the father of 32 pure-line children of the first garden. He wanted to remain with his parents and assist them in upbuilding the second garden, but he was greatly disturbed by the loss of his mate and their children, who had all elected to go to Edentia along with the other Adamic children, who chose to become wards of the Most Highs. Adamson would not desert his parents and was disinclined to flee from hardship or danger, but he found the associations of the second garden far from satisfying. He did much to forward the early activities of defense and construction, but decided to leave for the north at the earliest opportunity. And though his departure was wholly pleasant, Adam and Eve were much grieved to lose their eldest son, to have him go out into a strange and hostile world, as they feared, never to return. A company of 27 followed Adamson northward in quest of the children of his childhood fantasies. In a little over 3 years, Adamson's party actually found the object of their adventure, and among those people he discovered a wonderful and beautiful woman, 20 years old, who claimed to be the last pure-line descendant of the prince's staff. This woman, Radda, said that her ancestors were all descendants of two of the fallen staff of the prince. She was the last of her race, having no living brothers or sisters. She had about decided not to mate and had made up her mind to die without issue, but she lost her heart to the majestic Adamson. And when he heard the story of Eden, and when she heard the story of Eden, how the predictions of Van and Amadon had really come to pass, and as she listened to the recital of the garden default, she was so encompassed with a single thought, to marry the son and heir of Adam. And quickly the idea grew upon Adamson. She's 20. I can see that. In a little more than 3 months, they were married. Adamson and Radda had a family of 67 children. What a great line. They gave origin to a great line of the world's leadership, but they did something more. It should be remembered that both of these beings were really superhuman. Every fourth child born to them was of a unique order. It was often invisible. Never in the world's history had such a thing occurred. Duh!
Yeah, it would be hard to keep an invisible kid out of trouble.
That's right. Radda was greatly perturbed. Even superstitious. But Adamson well knew of the existence of the primary midwayers, and he concluded that something was transpiring before his eyes.
That he couldn't see.
Right. When the second strangely behaving offspring arrived, he decided to mate them, since one was male and the other was female.
Daddy, do I have to? That's my sister.
And that's the origin of the secondary order of midwayers. funny. What a corny story. A 120-year-old guy takes off on a quest, finds a 20-year-old girl. He's got 67 kids. Some of them are often invisible. Oh, God. I guess you would have had to have been there.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's hysterical.
Oh, it's true, too. I mean, you know, you take it out of context. It's like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. What's that, the deal?
I love those guys, the Midwayers. They're awesome.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, talk about the real heroes of this planet. And that's them. Because the book goes on to tell us that they've been here since then, right? They're just outside of the realm of human vision. They're decidedly material. Much of what angels have been given credit for was actually their doing. There's only 1,111 of them on this planet to minister to 6 billion people?
Wow.
They are busy, and they are devoted. And they are, you know, maybe you can clarify this for me, Jim. Doesn't it say that all planets have secondary and primary midwayers?
Oh, yeah. This is one of those things where I've forgotten more than I remembered.
Okay.
You know, I think it's often the case, and I think it's certainly, I believe there's primary, but I'm not sure about the secondaries, but I wouldn't be surprised. But then we are so off track, and we're really out there winging it. I mean, if you stop and think, you know, that in our local the universe, there's been 3 rebellions, and in those, there were 37 worlds that went bad, of which ours was one of the worst of the worst. And that when we have, you know, I just don't think that anywhere in the whole universe do people actually think that they're the only world in the universe. And so when we have, you know, kind of creatures here, we think we're maybe special. But I think they are probably everywhere. And, you know, I think that there's probably all kinds of other assistance that we might have that other worlds don't have. I don't know. It's just, but in a sense, you know, does any of it really matter? You know, we've got our work ahead of us that's the same, no matter, you know, how many unseen assistants that we have. You know, but we are told that, you know, what, close to 3,000 are still on the planet. And you got to wonder what they think about all of this stuff going on. Because, some of them have been here 500,000 years? Some of them, 37,000 years? And they're born here, much like we are. And in a sense, they're finite. But they don't die. It's so hard to keep track of all of these myriads of creatures.
Maybe they are the undead.
That explains our fascination with vampires.
Well, I thought of another joke when you were talking about Adamson and, you know, going after a 20-year-old gal. Well, there are 2 priests who die at the same time, and they meet St. Peter at the pearly gates. And St. Peter says, you know, I'd really like to get you guys in now, but our computers are down. I'm afraid you're going to have to go back to Earth for about a week. But just to make it up for you, you know, you can go back as anything you want except for humans. So what'll it be? The first priest says, well, let's see. He says, you know, I've always wanted to be able to soar like an eagle. I'd like to be an eagle, just soaring above the Rocky Mountains. So be it, says St. Peter, and off flies the first priest. And the second priest mulls this over for a while, and he says, well, I have to ask. He says, will you be keeping track of us, St. Peter? No. And he says, I told you, the computer's down. There's no way we can keep track of what you're doing. So this week is just a total freebie. Well, in that case, said the second priest, I've always wanted to be a stud. Well, so be it, said St. Peter, and the second priest disappears. A week goes by, and the computer is back up, and the Lord tells St. Peter to recall the two priests. He says, will you have any trouble locating them? Well, St. Peter says, the first one should be easy. He's somewhere over the Rocky Mountains flying with the eagles. But that second one could prove a little bit more difficult. And why is that? Asked the Lord. Well, because he's on a snow tire somewhere in Alaska.
He's on a snow tire somewhere in Alaska. That is great.
Okay.
Hey, here's one for you, Jim, from the board, in which you may have seen it already. But
no, I'm not looking at the chat. No.
Bro Dave on the board posted the United Midwayers slogan, which this is an inside joke, friends, for your Rancho book readers will get this one, but the United Midwayers have a slogan, and their slogan is, what the United Midwayers undertake, the United Midwayers do.
And my hoorah, friend, hoorah. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, my dear friend Chris Riggio, I know you guys know
Chris.
He came up with a human equivalent. It is the humans of your Rancho. What we set out to do, we do.
Oh, yes. That sounds like a Riggioism.
Yeah, it's definitely a Riggioism for sure. So what we set out to do, we do.
We
and,
do.
We
do a lot.
And it's not to do about nothing, right?
Here's another little vignette from the book from 1186. This is about how fast our adjusters. It says, when once the adjusters are actually dispatched from Divinington, practically no time intervenes between that moment and the hour of their appearance in the minds of their chosen subjects. The average transit time of an adjuster from Divinington to Urantia is 117 hours, 42 minutes, and 7 seconds. Virtually all of this time is occupied with registration on Uversa. You have to get through customs, right? It's red. What a bureaucracy.
It's just red tape everywhere.
Going through security.
Yeah, can't you just see the adjusters in a line waiting to do their clearance?
Tapping their foot, looking at their watch.
Oh, that's
good.
Boy. That's like the relay that message that, what was it, Van sent that got stuck in a relay for how many thousands of years? And poor Van didn't any answer back and thought they'd forgotten about us.
Or that great, great line that Adamson and Andon and Fonta wanted to send their greetings, but their request was wisely
denied.
Right. I wish I could have heard from them. Jeez, I wish they'd stop.
I wish they could have said hello at least.
How to get around the bureaucracy.
Right. Oh, boy. One of the plays that I wrote was about the story of Adamson, of Andon Infanta. And I wrote that play, which was the scene of them out in the woods trying to figure out to start fire using a bird's nest, and I wrote that play just so I could use one line, which was after he finally got the fire started, he said, "Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle."
I'll be a monkey's uncle.
Oh, that's bad. I'm sorry.
I had to write a whole play just to use
that's
that.
That's a groaner.
I thought you were going to say something like she said, "Well, it's about time." Yeah.
Some of the other plays that I've written over the years, one was called Life's Vicissitudes, and was an acting out of that wonderful imagery of the snarling hulk of a human in his fur clothing, you know, with a club in hand, and then elaborating that scene to include a saber-toothed tiger in front of them and a woman and child behind them, and the idea that even in that kind of a situation there's nobility of character, that people are doing the best towards what is good within their perspective with who they are and what they have. And this whole idea is that it's not so important where we are today, but who we are becoming day by day, and what are our goals, what are our ideals, what are we striving towards, what is our purpose, what brings us the joy to live the love of life, how do we move towards a greater self and a greater civilization. And it's all a lot of little steps, a lot of little yeses. It's a lot of working together. We're gradually, making the world a better place. And that same, can you imagine still having, 400-500-pound saber-toothed tigers roaming the neighborhood? Personally, I'm kind of glad that we had those guys with clubs to take them out. We've got our own saber-toothed tigers of indolence or apathy that we have to find that inner caveman to show some strength and to show some character in our own lives as well.
That was pretty good. Those qualities are primal, really. To me, that story, and of course I've met reader after reader after reader who list it as one of their all-time favorites from the book,
mm-hmm.
The Cave Story, because it is a classic paradigm shift. They give you this beautiful visualization of this caveman breathing hate and animosity, club upraised, standing legs spread, club upraised as he breathes fiercely just ahead. And then it says, such a picture hardly depicts the divine dignity of man, but let us expand the picture. And then they tell you that in front of him is a saber-toothed tiger and behind him is a woman and two children.
Mm-hmm.
The caveman is the same in both pictures, but it's in the second picture that you are favored with a widened horizon, a broader sketch of his motives and sentiments. And now he becomes admirable because you see, you understand him. And they throw the gauntlet down for us. They say, if only you could come to know your fellows, you would certainly fall in love with them. And if each day or each week you can come to know just one more of your fellows, or each year, then you are truly socializing and spiritualizing your personality. It's such a poignant lesson for humanity. I think it also feeds over to Jesus when he said, by their fruits you will know them. Because what he's essentially saying to me is, you can't judge a person's fruits in an instant. You have to take time to get to know them. You can't tell if they're kind or loyal or loving or sympathetic or understanding, you know, trustworthy. You can't make those judgments in an instant. You have to get to know a person to decide whether or not they have fruits of the Spirit. And I think our human tendency is to write people off just so we don't have to deal with them. You know what I mean? We can put them in a slot. Oh, they're just this and they're just that. And, you know, it's not any of my business and I don't have to deal with it. And I think it's because relationships take time and effort. And
I think a lot of Urantia book readers think that somehow there's a great and special service that they need to do, or that they need to go somewhere where the service is happening, or that it's somehow often the future. And through my life now, as I reflect back, some of the greatest personal heroes of mine have been hardworking parents, people who have, you know, done what they could for their kids, and you know, worked in service groups in the in their community, and were good neighbors, good citizens. You know, life is a day's work. Do it well. The act is ours, but the consequence is God's. I mean, it's just, you know, do your job as who you are, and you know, do good work. Don't do things that rip people off or make things worse. You know, try and find ways to be of service as you pass by in your job. Choose a career. Try and find something that's the best service for your skills, your innate talents and abilities, and you know, try and work those towards truth, beauty, and goodness. But boy, you know, first and foremost, be a good parent. Be a good mom, be a good dad, and be a good kid. I mean, just, you know, be a great family. That's just so basic, so instrumental that I think we often think that the service is something else or somewhere else. And I think it's been somewhat tragic that so many book readers, such as even I was when I was first reading, really think that disseminating the book and sharing the book is the service. And they forget that the real service is to be a loving, kind person first and foremost. And that people who are ready for it will be drawn or come to the U-book. I don't think the U-book is that important for civilization. What's important is for people to find ways and to be of service in most cases without the book. And maybe that's arrogance for those who have had the gift of its understanding, but you know, so many people that I see in my work and as I travel around the world who are just being happy, doing good, you know, whether it's a guy just, you know, making small things on the curbside in China, or a farmer in Thailand, or a taxi cab driver in Cairo. You know, it doesn't matter. It's all service. And I think people are doing fundamentally great. I think that there's just really fine things going on, and I have so much hope and great expectations for the future. It really saddens me that so many people are full of angst, or that they're not just bought into the traditions of some religion, that this is a world of suffering or a world of sorrow and a world of torment and trial, or that some in the environmental movement who think that man is the problem, and that if it's human, it's cursed, or it's, you know, tainted and is therefore not natural. If there's one great truth that I've gotten out of the Urantia book, is that it's okay to be human. We have the right to be here. We're supposed to be here. We're okay. The world's okay. That we're loved and God is a loving being and that life is a part of the universe, Mother Spirit, and the universe is a part of a great ascension plan, of which some of it is a descension plan to come back into the world. And it's just great to be alive. And if there's one thing that I would like to share, and one of the reasons why I guess I try and be funny quite a bit, is let's have fun doing this, folks. This is just, you know, life doesn't have to be hard. Life can be fun. There's a joy in caring. There's a joy in, you know, taking care of obligations. There's a joy in getting the work done. And, you know, I think this is swell stuff.
Hear, 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 hear. Keep your mind on the sunny side of life. As the old, the ending of The Life of Brian. One of my favorite scenes, you know, at the end where they have all those guys up on the crucifixes. And they're all singing and, you know, kicking their feet off the side of the cross. Singing, keep your mind on the sunny side of life.
Yeah.
Well, we have a request from the board, and it's a special day for somebody who we love dearly and who helps us out every week, every day. He's somebody that has worked with me on various projects in your Rancher project since 1996. When he and I, and even before that, we used to do expos in Sacramento together. And he was always our liaison there. And then in 1996, he and I set out to create the JesusOnion.org website. And he is now our tech guy on the board, and he takes care of us on the board. He lists all of our shows. He sends out notices to all of our guests. He's the ever stalwart and faithful dear brother and friend, Larry Watkins, and today is his birthday. So happy birthday, Larry.
Happy birthday, Larry.
We love you, bro.
We couldn't do this without you.
Yeah. How old are you, Larry? He's escaping.
Run away,
I know, Jim, earlier you were almost 60. I think Larry has been around the planet at least 60 times. Or I should say he's been around the sun on the planet.
Right.
At least. So happy birthday, Larry. Anyway, you know, what you just said, Jim, reminded me of something that I often tell people when I lecture, and I've had the great honor and privilege of being able to do a lot of public lectures about the Urantia book and encouraging people to read it, not because they have to, but because it just makes such a difference to know the truth, that you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. And I often go into these lectures with a simple prayer, and that is, Father, you know, just let me leave them with something they can keep, whether or not they read the Urantia book. A nugget of truth they can keep and take with them. And that'll help them in their day or their life or whatever. And one of the things that I often say in the lecture is that as the universe looks at us, they don't see despicable, lowly, miserable mortals, sinners. Quite the contrary, they see heroes. People who, and you just described, you know, the cab driver in Cairo, the merchant in China, everyday people who step out of their door on this most difficult planet and make the best of it and smile and love their children and work hard and give it all they've got to make it a good life. And to honor and uphold whatever is true and good and decent in humanity. And, you know, I often point out that, you know, over the years we've all grown up with these images of people starving on the planet. And, you know, we've seen the haunting images of a mother holding a child at her breast, and they're both obviously starving. And how easy would it be for her to just end her life and end her child's life? Give it up. It's not worth the misery. And yet she clings to the hope eternal that springs eternally within the human heart, that tomorrow could be a better day. And tomorrow she might have food, and her child might have food. And the angels in the universe look at her and say, look at the spirit of this human. She's a hero, and we all are. We're heroes. We persevere through the most difficult of circumstances. And one of the beautiful things about this book is it gives us a sense of that, of who we are and how beautiful, how valued we are by our elder brothers and sisters in the universe, by our loving and well-ordered universe, you know. That we are treasured. And I really do think they look at us as heroes. And we do inspire. You're absolutely right, what you said earlier. We inspire not only the universe, but the universe of universes because of our perseverance and because of our faith and our courage. And we probably don't even know it. But it's one of those things that's the ultimate blessing in disguise. I know I made a joke earlier about Eggendaughters, and certainly that was only a joke, because in reality I think what we'll find as we ascend is that coming from this planet will be a great conversation starter.
Yeah, like, you know? Whoa, you're from Urantia? Yeah. No way.
Yeah, exactly.
I wrote a poem back in the 1980s that came from a line from the book here. Some of you know I work designing composting systems and with earthworms and making soils, and I was really struck by a particular quote, and I decided to write a poem about it, called Worms of the Dust. Thriving when the light is gone, our friends in the underground, Darwin tells us, show purpose in their movements, intelligence in their undertakings. They can see without eyes, hear without ears, believe without seeing, and live in the refuse of the universe. Each one eternal, never dying. What noble creatures of the earth, what sense of survival, over 350 million years strong, who convert the decay of death into the spontaneity of life. Zen masters, everyone, bodhisattvas in our midst, going into the world at its foulest to bring us forth the pure land. As spoke Michael on Urantia, man may be a worm of the dust by nature and origin, but when he becomes indwelt by my Father's Spirit, that man becomes divine in his destiny.
Wow.
Beautiful poem.
That's really nice. Who would have thought you could write something that sentimental about worms?
The whole process of the resurrection and life out of death and our fear of death, and that has so many of us, you know, deal with the inexplicability of death. And in many ways, we are very similar to the primitive tribes that are occasionally condescending authors of the papers chide us. But I think a lot of us have our ghosts that we have to overcome and come to recognize that that the process of death and rebirth are really beautiful and illuminating cycles. And as we seek to be of service to help feed those hungry children, that a big part of it begins with the importance of topsoil. It begins with the importance of being stewards of the earth, not oxidizers, to help bring about a better world each year for when it was given to us. And that as we look at our accomplishments during our lifetime, have we just consumed for our own self-interest, or have we given back towards the greater good? The supreme being isn't just the collective consciousness of all humans, but there's a brotherhood of citizens of this earth, that we are here and have civilization because of the hard work of those who have come before us. And it's ever our responsibility to make sure that civilization goes forward and that it moves on, and we move progressively each generation towards light and life. And a part of that has to begin with learning how to feed ourselves. And as I often say, the old saying goes, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, or teach a man a fish, you feed him for life. Well, we're learning to go beyond that. We're now teaching people fish farming. We're teaching people how to raise fish food. We're teaching people how to take the wastewater from fish processing and grow their fish food with it, and how to export fish, and how to be generative, not just sustainable, not just good enough, but to take the talents that we've been given and make more of it, not just to give it back as it was given to us, but to be creative, to do better, to make the world a better place, to bring forth life and beauty, and to bring joy and truth. But it always has to come down to, let's take care of biological necessities. Let's look at the work of the Prince of Staff, and it was primarily health, sanitation, social, civil work. These spiritual groups were really just about one-tenth of what the Prince of Staff were up to. Let's never forget the importance of the material work that needs to be done here on Earth right now.
That's a great point. You know,
yeah.
We frequently don't think of the fact that, you know, we probably would have learned so much better how to be good stewards of the land and of the planet, you know, had they not defaulted, had they still stuck around. And we pretty much have to figure it out for ourselves. And while that might be challenging, it's also a great opportunity for us to really, you know, put our heads together and come up with solutions to all the problems. We don't ever have to feel like there's nothing to do.
Well, that's for sure. I think one of the things, and certainly one of the reasons to keep smiling and keep laughing, is that, you know, we simply need to, if we didn't, we'd become overwhelmed by the problems we face as humankind. But it's also to keep perspective. We just need to keep perspective that every generation can only progress a little bit, and it's a long, long journey. It's a long, long evolutionary journey we're on, and each one of us gives something to the process, but not any of us can give all to the process. We just have to contribute what we have to give, and then we move on. And the next generation contributes what they have, and so on. And that's another thing that I love about the Arantia book, is that it gives you a sense of that this is a process. It's not going to happen overnight. We have problems, and we're working on them. We're working them out. And every little, you know, step forward we take is fraught with new difficulties and new obstacles to overcome. And that's how we grow. And it's all good, like you said, Jim. It's we just have to do it. We have to give it the best, our best shot. You know, I'm interested in of course, as we all are, this catastrophe in off the coast of Louisiana. And suddenly, you know, we were thinking about drilling more wells, and now all of a sudden, boom, right in our face, the disaster.
And your Rancho book gives us a very unique perspective on evolution and on a sense of history of the earth and why life is here, and I think that gives us an insight that so many of our associates don't have. Like for one, I mean, what was the prayer of Onagar, the first truth teacher? It was, "Please, Lord, save us from the curse of the ice." The big problem back then was the ice ages and global cooling and bringing about incredible struggle for the early humans. And now that the ice has retreated and the planet continues to, you know, go warm, well, how can Onagar's prayer not be answered, which is the great salubrious climate that we have now? But it really comes down to humans as stewards. And I think that the U book gives us so much of a different perspective on the place and the role of humans within the biosphere. And when we start to realize that we are cultivators, we are here to make the world friendly place for humans to live in, that we start to see the impacts of some of our human activity. And is it bringing about truth? Is it bringing about beauty? Is it bringing about goodness? And we really have to take a look at how we're managing our biological systems, because as we continue to rely on fossil fuels, which from an odd point of view, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is part of how the world has warmed up to the point where it can be more productive. In a sense, global warming is a good thing in that regard, but so many people think it's a bad thing simply because it's influenced by humans. But then we look at a spill like what's going off on the coast right now, the biological and ecological consequences of that are just going to be, like you said, devastating, possibly for a generation or more. And I think it's time that we come to grips with the fact that we are biological creatures and we have biological needs and consequences, and we need to take care of ourselves, clean up after ourselves, have proper sanitation, protect public health, and not rely on activities that can bring about biohazards and do things instead that bring about the furtherance and fostering of life. And I think people are coming to realize right now that from the centuries of topsoil erosion and the wars that come out of famines and the devastation of communities from the misuse of industrial chemicals and the negative byproducts of the fossil fuel industry, people are coming to realize that we need a new ethic of humans working in harmony with the biosphere rather than fighting it and rather than exploiting it.
You know, I always think that it's a process of, instead of looking down, because humanity has been looking down at the earth for, you know, thousands and thousands of years, and only in the latter part of the 20th century did we start looking up. and it's just a matter of time before we quit digging for finite resources and realize that the universe is full of infinite resources. The power of the universe is infinite, and we can tap into that. We've always been able to. We just never looked up. And yeah, I mean, we're starting to now realize that we don't have to depend on finite resources, which are finite. They're destined to run out. And we can start doing what we want and need to do with the infinite resources that the universe provides. And I think you were one of the first people that ever pointed out Nikola Tesla to me.
Uh-huh.
And, which has been a fascination for me ever since. What a misunderstood and Renaissance man he was, and how he really, in some respects, tapped into some of those infinite resources.
How many people today, after an incredible invention such as his, alternating current, the electric motor as we currently know it, would say to George Westinghouse, who helped finance it, say, I want to thank you for helping to bring light to the world. There are fabulous inventions and opportunities and ways to be of service. And I think with the power of God, and as I was alluding to earlier, with the special power of the Master Son, the personalized adjuster of Jesus, that I think there are powers and resources that can help us overcome the sense of scarcity or fear of depletion. And yes, there are finite resources here on Earth, and there are certain things that have to be conserved. But when we have spiritual attitudes applied to material problems, they become much more easily solved. And I think the attitude of abundance that we're seeing in a lot or quite a few of the modern Christian preachers, I think is helping to bring people to a sense of not just personal wealth, but of the wealth of community, the wealth of our ability to work together, the wealth that we have when we apply a common purpose towards a problem. And that I really believe that there will become a time within easily a few generations where the scarcity of what I call the four F's of food, fuel, fiber, and fertilizer will become things of the past, because we will have become so efficient in converting sunlight and carbon dioxide and renewable biomass into the resources that we need to feed ourselves that it is attainable. It is something that's achievable within a few generations. And in many cases, a lot of parts of the world within our lifetime, just by putting our minds to it.
Right. Hey, we have a call, guys. Hold on. 714, you're on Block Talk.
Hey, Jim, this is your brother, Pat.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, just want to tell you what a fun time I've had this morning listening to you and chatting with the other people online, and it's just great to hear you and in the positive spirit, and It's just been a great time, and thanks, Anne, and thanks, Paula, and for this wonderful service.
Well, thank you, Patrick. It's great to have you, and you know, it is fun. We have fun every Saturday on the board and on Blog Talk, and we've been doing it for almost 2 years now. So, it's become like our Saturday study group.
Well, I've been kind of multitasking, going outside and hoeing weeds, and I've got 4 bags of compost that I'm going to be making later on, and kind of, you know, makes me just, you know, and I'm also going downtown. We have a thing in Fullerton today called Faces of Fullerton, where we have all the different people from downtown and different community groups, and so I'm going to be going down there later on, and so this is kind of a little start to my beautiful day here in Southern California.
Oh, wonderful.
Wonderful.
Well, nice to have you call in, Pat.
Well, Jim, are you in New Mexico right now?
No, I'm not heading down to New Mexico till Sunday. That's tomorrow, and then heaven knows where I'm going to be next. I'm just got composting projects popping up all over the world now. It's going to be a fun part of my life to, you know, help to bring about this kind of transformation that I've been talking about, and do it with my career as well as in my own backyard.
I want to say something too to all the other people that are listening. Jim is no just talker when it comes to his love and care for the planet and for soil and for earthworms and for all the and for soil regeneration projects, and he's committed his whole life to this, and it's an honor to be his brother, and it's an honor to have known him through the Urantia group, and as well as just as a family member who's more than just a brother to me. And I just want to thank you, Jim, and I love your poetry too. And you know, I don't know if I've ever heard that one that you wrote or that you read online today, absolutely wonderful stuff.
Sure is.
Thanks a lot, bro. Yeah, there were a couple of brothers hanging with Jesus too, and it's great that you and I are conspirators, and we're going to keep at it, and we're going to be on this planet for some time yet.
Yep, got a lot of stuff to still do. I just took my Chipper Shredder in yesterday to have it serviced. It's the one that I got from the Fosters years ago, an old 92 Baker, 8 horsepower. So it hadn't been serviced, I don't think, ever since it was made, so it needs to be a little bit of maintenance on it, and so getting ready to keep up making more batches and feeding more worms.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to read on my tombstone, still feeding worms.
Still feeding worms.
Yeah, you can write on mine, he left the soil better than he found it.
There you go. You know, Patrick, what you bring up is important. I think we could really have Jim do a whole show on what he does. And as I recall, Jim, years ago, you felt a very strong commission to help to end world hunger and restore the soil of the world, and have been working with earthworms for years and years and years. When I first met you 30 years ago, you had a company called Mother Earthworms, and you were creating
Planet Earthworms, right. Yeah.
Planet Earthworms, right, right. And it's just, you know, bravo. Bravo for a life of service. You too, Patrick. You guys are wonderful brothers, and you come from a great family. And
since 1974, Jim and I started a worm project, and I still have descendants of those, and I know Jim does too. And it's really quite an accomplishment that to be able to work with an organism like that for so long, and to know that you know, if you want to create topsoil, you just have to feed earthworms.
Isn't that true? And you know, I think you guys have taught me that more than anybody. I don't think people really appreciate, if they don't know, how precious and valuable those beautiful earthworms are. And when I dig in my garden now and I find one, I bless it. And I set it free to go back and do its work.
When my stepdaughter, Reagan, was helping me work on the garden, she really, really wanted to have a job. And so it became her job to go out and find earthworms in other parts of the yard to bring them back to the garden. And she took this job very seriously, and I'll tell you, she got really good at finding earthworms all over the place. But it's something really fun for kids to do, too.
It is. It really is.
We're in the last.
Like, we are almost out of time. We're down to 1 minute remaining.
Almost done here.
It's been so much fun, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on, and just want to put out a word that Ann does the show on Wednesday, and this week Dr. Chuck is coming back. He was with her last week, I believe, or maybe the week before. And I hope you guys keep tuning in, and And thanks so much for coming, Jim, and love to have you back on sometime just to talk about your work. That would be awesome.
If we've got a couple of seconds here, from page 2017, this is part of the Reverend Jimmy Act, where it says that this concept of atonement and sacrificial salvation is rooted and grounded in selfishness. Jesus taught that service to one's fellows is the highest concept of the Brotherhood of Spirit Believers. Salvation should be taken for granted by those who believe in the Fatherhood of God. The believer's chief concern should not be the selfish desire for personal salvation, but rather the unselfish urge to love and therefore serve one's fellows, even as Jesus loved and served mortal men.
Hear, hear.
Amen.
What a great place to end it. Thanks for calling in, Patrick. It was great to hear from you.
Great. It was my pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for your work.
Yeah, you bet.
Talk to you later.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Have a great week.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, Paula and Crystalline, and I hope that we brought a little joy and mirth into the world today.
Thanks.
And tomorrow is World Laughter Day, so.
Everybody remember to laugh tomorrow and tell all your friends. Tomorrow is World Laughter Day.
Thanks again.
See you soon.
Okay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry.